Okay, our next module today, Integrating New Advances into the Care of Patients with Cancer, a multi-tumor symposium in partnership with American Oncology Network. We're blessed to have as faculty our friends here from UCLA, Dr. Konecny. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
So we're going to be discussing ovarian cancer, and again, the format will be the same. We'll show some data with respect to patient populations within the AON network. And go through a slide deck that's we probably didn't allow you enough time to really cover everything, and then we'll go into some question and answers, okay?
Pleasure.
Again, Dr. Konecny is from UCLA. No conflicts of interest. So this is a snapshot throughout the AON practices for patients with ovarian cancer with an identified BRCA1 or 2 mutation. This looks at utilization patterns for olaparib and niraparib based on approvals in those spaces. Utilization of mirvetuximab based on folate receptor 1 alpha and trastuzumab, TDXD, in that setting for the PanHER2 indications. So without further ado, Dr. Konecny, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. I wanted to give you a brief update on treatment strategies in ovarian cancer in 2025. Just reviewing the last few slides, I saw a little change in the trend of practice with PARP inhibitors and ADCs, and I'll comment on that moving forward. I wanted to briefly focus on what's changed with the use of PARP inhibitors in ovarian cancer. This is a slide summarizing basically the old indications of the use of niraparib and olaparib, and you can see we have upfront use as maintenance. We use it as maintenance in the platinum-sensitive recurrent setting, but you also use it as a treatment strategy, and the orange bars show those are all the differences that happened in the last 2 years where the FDA withdrew the approval based on so-called dear doctor letters that you all received, basically because they saw no survival improvement with extended follow-up, and they also saw new safety signals that I'll comment on. I think the bottom line is that if we use PARP inhibitors in an unrestricted way, it does impact the ability to give subsequent chemotherapy, and there is a risk of MDS and secondary leukemias, which is higher than what we anticipated initially. And this is just one of the examples. You see this extremely exciting data in an early journal in the New England Journal of a PARP inhibitor, niraparib, as the maintenance therapy, extending progression-free survival. But then you look at the overall survival, no impact, even in those groups where you think it should particularly work well, like the BRCA-mutated patients, where there was just a minimal, non-significant improvement and even a detrimental effect in those that are HR-proficient or non-germline BRCA-mutated. So the practice has clearly changed, and you can see these is a summary, a busy slide, but it really summarizes the risk of MDS and AML. Again, the first data we heard was a rare incidence of about 1%, 2%. But if you look at the data with longer follow-up now, for example, in the SOLO 2 study, there's an 8% risk of MDS. If you've been on a PARP inhibitor for more than 24 months, it goes up to 11%. And in some cases, if you have a germline mutation, you can see it's actually up to 15%. This is very different from the rates. Now, it's important to keep in mind that some of these data are from studies where patients have had multiple prior platinum agents, so it's not just the PARP inhibitor. And I do want to emphasize the risk of MDS in the frontline maintenance setting is still extremely low. But using it in the recurrent setting is a different situation. Again, state of the art in 2025 is clearly the use of a PARP inhibitor does extend progression-free survival, but only in the subset of HRD-deficient patients or those that have a BRCA mutation. So recently the FDA withdrew the indication for niraparib as an all-comer PARP inhibitor with no efficacy in the HR-proficient group, only in the HRD-deficient. If you look at the data on survival, it's quite obvious there's no survival improvement in either of these molecular subtypes. So I think there's only a role for a PARP inhibitor such as niraparib as a maintenance therapy in the frontline setting because of a significant improvement in PFS, but unfortunately no overall survival, and we can get to that why there's a difference. If you look at the olaparib data, and I think that's also reflected in the uptick that we see more use of olaparib versus niraparib now as compared to 2 years ago. This is the data with olaparib. extended follow-up for the SOLO-1 study in BRCA mutation carriers. So treating the right patient with the right drug, you see a 20% improvement in overall survival in the BRCA mutation carriers. And in the PAOLA study, you see a similar improvement, those that are HRD deficient. So clearly, if you have a BRCA mutation or a similar mutation in HRD deficiency, homologous recombination deficiency, there is a use. And the difference, why is there a difference between niraparib and olaparib? I think it's study design issues. Niraparib was given for a longer time. More patients progressed while being on niraparib that may impact the response to subsequent treatments. Let me rush on to novel antibody drug conjugates. Again, in ovarian and in GYN cancers, we have three ADCs that are now approved. Mirvetuximab soravtansine, targeting the folate receptor with a microtubulin inhibitor payload. We now have TDXD available for patients with high expression of HER2, and we have tisotumab vedotin, a tissue factor targeting ADC with an MMAE payload. The first approved ADC in ovarian cancer targeting the folate receptor was based on the Mirasol data, which showed the efficacy of mirvetuximab soravtansine compared to standard of care like weekly Taxol, doxorubicin, topotecan, which met its endpoint in all primary and secondary endpoints, improved response rates, improved progression-free, improved overall survival, improved quality of life. So clearly a practice-changing treatment, however restricted to those patients that have high folate receptor expression, that is 2-plus intensity 75%, which is about a third of patients with platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. This is ESMO data, just 2 weeks old. Katie Moore updated the impact on PFS2, carries over. Patients that are on mirvetuximab respond better to their second subsequent treatment. Clinical trials are now moving mirvetuximab into different scenarios. This is the first study that looks at its activity in platinum-sensitive recurrent disease, and you see very promising data in the sense that the objective response rate, and I think the fine print is very interesting, looking at the prior treatment of a PARP inhibitor, you can see the objective response rate of a single-agent folate receptor-targeting ADC, no prior exposure to PARP, was 75% response rate, which is very comparable to a platinum combination chemotherapy. And interestingly, the response drop up if you've had prior PARP inhibitor treatment down to 45 to 46 or progressed on a PARP inhibitor. And that's also very consistent with platinum response rates, where if you've been on a PARP inhibitor, you see less activity as compared to PARP naive treated patients. It's also opening up a new discussion about the role of, you know, this distinction between platinum-sensitive and platinum-resistant, which is quite an arbitrary cutoff, and I think there is really, it's blurring the line with new drugs moving into the space of ovarian cancer. The other ADC that's approved for recurrent ovarian, cervical, and endometrial cancer is based on the Destiny Pan tumor study. You're aware of it from other tumor indications, but really impressive data. Albeit in a very small sample size of patients, you can see in platinum-resistant, most of these patients were platinum-resistant, really high response rates between 80 and 75% if you have 3-plus intensity. Interestingly, there is a correlation between the expression of HER2 and the response, so the lower the HER2 expression, slightly lower, but still very impressive response rates considering what we have available as standard of care, like a 47, 40%, 36% response rate in 2-plus intensity. So this is now approved, FDA approved for 3-plus intensity GYN malignancies, albeit NCCN does list the drug for 2-plus and 3-plus intensity. This is, sorry, very small print, but was just updated at ESMO 2 weeks ago, which doesn't just report the response rates, but shows you the median progression-free survival and the overall survival. And you can see there's a significant improvement in median progression-free survival in those that have 3-plus intensity, very promising data, as well as overall survival. So clearly the 3-plus is the group that benefits the most with higher response rates, very promising median progression-free survival, and really promising overall survival. This is conditionary approval, so confirmatory studies are ongoing now. that will hopefully keep this drug in the space for platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. Now, the space in ovarian cancer and GYN malignancies has become, thankfully, very crowded. This is just one slide showing you, three novel deruxtecan ADCs moving into the GYN space. We have Dato-DXd, R-DXd, I-DXd targeting B7-H3, Caterin-6 or TROP2 moving forward in endometrial and ovarian cancer. And I'm unfortunately, you had to take out a few slides because of the busyness of trials, but there are three other folate receptor targeting ADCs now in development with Lilly, Rina-S, and additional targets like B7-H4, Claudin-6, and other TROP2 like sacituzumab, tirometican moving forward. So it's become, as a clinical investigator, a little confusing is which drug is really going to succeed. And I wanted to show you, I think, a promising candidate moving forward that we should be tuned in with. It's R-DXd, which is targeting a protein highly expressed in ovarian cancer, which is Caterin-6. And this is the new model of drug development with the FDA intended to use a dose optimization strategy from phase one going into phase two. And it's intended to really develop drugs differently, not use them at their MTD when you go through phase one, but really see, is the drug active at lower doses that may be safer to give, but we're not compromising efficacy. The goal is to have an ADC that is better tolerated than standard of care chemotherapy, but clearly more effective. And this is the data that was presented at ESMO looking at the three doses that the investigators took forward, 4.8, 5.6, 6.4, and a large study, about 90 patients, 107 patients. You can see outstanding activity regardless of what dose you gave, 44, 50, 57, not a clear correlation with the dose and response. But if you look at the adverse events, you can see that the higher dose had significantly more adverse events. So the decision with the FDA was to take the intermediate dose forward. So really not using the dose below the MTD, but using an equally better tolerated dose forward. And the good news is that in that dose group, there were very manageable pulmonary toxicity events, which were of concern in earlier studies, less adverse events, better tolerability. So I think a model for drug development that the others are following suit. But this is a drug that I think we'll hear more moving forward now in phase three studies. Let me briefly comment on innovations in immunotherapy and recurrent disease. Again, just a few weeks old, ESMO presentation of the Keynote B96 study. This is a study that assessed the role of pembrolizumab in recurrent platinum-resistant, many of these refractory, adding it to weekly Taxol. Weekly paclitaxel, I apologize. This is a large study, 640 patients. I think what's important when we interpret these results and can discuss it a little bit later is that most of these patients only had two prior lines. Not generally a space where many of you go and use weekly taxane treatment, but that's a characteristic. If you look at the CPS score, again, the majority of patients had PD-L1 expression. About 30% had more than 10 CPS score. If you look at the data, it was a highly anticipated study, a little bit of a hype about it before the data were released. There is a significant improvement in progression-free survival. However, the difference numerically is relatively small, in my opinion. But what's more relevant is the overall survival improvement, which was significant at a p-value of 0.05 and a hazard ratio of 0.76. A lot of censored data at the end, but again, this is an unrestricted population of patients by adding an immune checkpoint inhibitor to weekly paclitaxel led to a significant improvement in progression-free survival. This drug is filing for approval in this indication, so we'll see how the FDA decides. As to be expected, an increased rate of immune-mediated adverse events, but well manageable when adding it. This is a summary slide of the outcome. There's a new kid on the block with recurrent ovarian cancer, and that's targeting the glucocorticoid receptor. This is a drug that came as a surprise. When it was offered to us at UCLA, I actually turned the study down because I said, I don't think this will be a drug that will really make a difference. But little did I know at that time. The glucocorticoid receptor signaling seems to be very important and is involved in regulating apoptosis, and by inhibiting that receptor, you may enhance the apoptotic signaling pathway, pro-apoptotic signaling, which could synergize with chemotherapy. And as a straightforward study, this was a study in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, taking a taxane, Abraxane, no use of steroids, but they were randomizing patients to the glucocorticoid receptor inhibitor, which is an oral medication, easy to give, 3 days in a row per week. And you could see that it led in patients with platinum-resistant disease to a significant improvement in progression-free survival at 6 months, 42 versus 52, and out at 12 months, 13 versus 25. This also led to an improvement in survival. Again, an endpoint that's very difficult to meet in ovarian cancer. There are only three studies that have shown an improvement in survival now. That was the Mirasol study, the data I just showed you with immune checkpoint inhibition added to weekly Taxol, and this is the third study that looks at an improvement in overall survival. So this is really meaningful data, again, filed for approval. I don't know how soon this agent will be available to be added to Abraxane, which was given at weekly dose of 80 milligrams per week, probably by mid-next year. And also interesting, secondary endpoints, reduced rate of ascites. I think that's a very important endpoint in platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. Many patients struggle with ascites, very difficult to treat, lower rates. Adverse events, slightly higher. I'd like to point out neutropenia, I think, is the leading side effect, grade 3, listed here, 25% without, 44% when adding relacorilant to the treatment. Unfortunately, they don't show grade 4 toxicities. I mean, grade 3, we're all used to that. We can manage that well. But I think we need a little more data for that. That basically summarizes briefly, I think, highlights that are worthy of discussion and discussion taking it forward in our management of patients with recurrent GYN malignancies.
Well, thank you for accomplishing that monumental task of going through quite a volume of data in just a few minutes. So I appreciate it, Dr. Konecny. We're going to level set with some cases now from physicians within the network.
We begin our module on ovarian cancer with a case from Dr. Mulhern, a 56-year-old woman who presented with 6 months of abdominal bloating and increased abdominal girth and was found to have an adnexal mass on imaging with enlarged retroperitoneal and iliac nodes and extensive ascites. At surgery, the patient had optimal debulking of a serous ovarian carcinoma and was later found to have a genetic mutation.
She had a PALB2 mutation, not BRCA, and you know, she's HRD positive and connected to that. So what's the optimal adjuvant therapy for this patient? Do you do olaparib, bevacizumab, you know, as in the Paola trial? What if the tumor was HRD negative and it didn't have any actionable mutations? Would you give them bevacizumab in that particular case? Would you do FR alpha testing up front? If it's been a while and someone progresses later, you know, it's been 3 years and they're platinum resistant, should you get another tissue biopsy to check for FR alpha, IHC or not? When do you do upfront debulking versus neoadjuvant therapy? Did they have potential resectable diseases? This person did. What's the kind of the current state of the field and what would the faculty recommend on there? Are there situations where they did have clearly resectable disease where, you really would want to do neoadjuvant therapy?
So what did you end up doing with this patient? What's her current status?
So she had carbo, Taxol, bevacizumab, and is now on bevacizumab and olaparib, and is now 9-10 months out from diagnosis and is doing well. Seems to be in CR.
Any tolerability issues with the olaparib?
Some mild issues, but not a lot.
Okay. Something we see in practice, you get a call from the ER, patients there with bloated abdominal distension, CT shows significant advanced disease, ascites, peritoneal disease, biopsy shows. So how do you decide when to begin with neoadjuvant therapy in these patients versus moving, you know, straight ahead, assuming you have a gynoc standing there waiting by with primary debulking surgery?
Well, clearly in the last years, we've seen a significant increase in the use of neoadjuvant or primary chemotherapy, and probably in 60 to 70% of cases now across the country, neoadjuvant chemotherapy is being used because studies have shown no detrimental effect. They've shown reduced morbidity, quicker recovery. They haven't shown improved overall survival. So it really doesn't matter if you start your chemotherapy prior to surgery, and the morbidity associated with debulking surgery is less. But there was data presented at ASCO this year which is challenging that a little bit again, which is the TRUST study, which a European group of investigators addressed. There were a few American sites there that said, well, we don't trust that old data because we think the surgeons did a sloppy job originally. Because if you look at the published data on neoadjuvant versus primary debulking surgery, the average time they spent in that OR was about 2 hours. And so U.S.-trained physicians that do a great job in primary debulking surgery said, I don't think that applies to the standards that are used in the United States. So the TRUST study selected their surgeons, high-volume centers, very carefully. They actually audited the surgeons. They went in and checked whether they are doing a good job. And that study showed that if you, it is feasible to do optimal cytoreductive surgery upfront, there was a small benefit by doing upfront surgery. Now, I don't think that's changing our practice, because in the U.S., generally the rule of thumb is I think a patient should undergo primary surgery if the surgeon deems she to be completely resectable, meaning no residual tumor. That's not or infrequently only the case. And there are some algorithms that the surgeons would use. But I think in general still, even with this new data, at least half or the majority of patients will undergo primary chemotherapy followed by interval cytoreductive surgery and then have subsequent surgery.
So as a corollary follow-up to that, let's say we start with, you know, primary chemotherapy or neoadjuvant systemic therapy. What's your standard number of cycles? And do you complete all six? Do you do half and then break in surgery? What is your preferred methodology?
I think we generally do 3 cycles to 4 cycles preoperative. We base the overall reasoning for the overall number of cycles on data from postoperative chemotherapy, where we know that more than 6 cycles does not improve overall survival. It may delay progression a little bit, but at that time point, toxicity starts to increase. So I would say if 4 cycles are given preoperatively, it's kind of just a desire to be symmetrical or what, that you give 3 or 4 after. But there's really no scientific data that anything more than 6 a total improves outcomes. We have no data yet to say you need to give more postoperatively.
So getting to a pathologic CR doesn't carry the same weight perhaps in other diseases if you...
Right, yeah, and it's unlikely that if you haven't achieved a CR after 6 cycles that it will suddenly happen at cycle 8 or 9, in ovarian cancer at least, yeah.
Okay, let's flip the script a little bit, and healthy 65-year-old female comes in, has disease that appears resectable, undergoes debulking laparotomy, has R0 resection, receives adjuvant carboplatin and paclitaxel. Genetic testing shows PALB2 mutation. So what are your thoughts on maintenance or adjuvant PARP therapy there based on this?
Well, PALB2 mutation, I think there's good data to show it's as predictive for response to PARP inhibitors as BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations are. And, I mean, there are other genes that have been involved in homologous recombination like ATM or CHEK2 mutations where the data across the board, be it in prostate or pancreatic or breast and ovarian cancer, show that it's not as predictive. But PALB2 clearly is one of those genes that translocates BRCA to the area of double strand break repair. So I think it's an important predictor. And in this case, rightfully, the patient was offered a PARP inhibitor.
So you sort of alluded to maybe not all our, you know, HRD is a complicated, includes large-scale transit, right? There are a lot of things that impact HRD, quote, status. And so, you know, in the prostate cancer world, we see response to PARP inhibitors vary based on mutation status. They're not all created equal here, but BRCA and PALB2 would be something you
would call them equally, yes, yeah. I think the other question that came up was whether, you know, whether you would give Avastin or bevacizumab. I try to separate them. I know there's the Paola data that combines both bevacizumab and a PARP inhibitor in HR-deficient ovarian cancer. The question is, how much benefit do you have by adding bevacizumab? Generally, I look at the other data that use bevacizumab as a single agent maintenance therapy, where we see very little benefit in an optimal cytoreduction case like this, an R0 resection where there is no residual disease, there is no residual tumor that depends on neoangiogenesis. There is only a minimal improvement in subsets analysis on PFS and no survival benefit. So I would not offer this patient bevacizumab. And there's an interesting study at ESMO also looking at a Chinese study with an oral TKI that inhibits VEGF. That was the first study to really look at a single-arm VEGF control in the maintenance setting, and it clearly showed inhibiting VEGF in addition to a PARP inhibitor in an HRD-deficient or BRCA-mutated does not add. It's really the PARP inhibitor that's doing the main lifting, the heavy lifting in improving PFS.
Are there any other biomarkers that you may want to evaluate? I mean, we obviously typically send large volume NGS panels on most of these folks now, and so I think Dr. Mulhern brought up.
What
if they're folate receptor alpha positive? We don't have data in that adjuvant space yet, but just thoughts about any other things.
I tend to include it all. I think with ovarian cancer, we kind of it becomes part of the core molecular characterization of a patient. You want to know germline, somatic, HRD, mutational status. You want to know if they're folate receptor, if they're HER2 positive. You may not use that drug at the initial diagnosis, but as you said, with next-gen sequencing platforms, it's just added on. It's just a checkbox, and you have the valuable information whether they may benefit from a drug that, unfortunately, with ovarian cancer, they're likely going to need further down the line.
Okay, next case, Dr. Iannucci.
The next case, presented by Dr. Iannucci, is a 61-year-old woman with a BRCA2 germline mutation who presented with a left inguinal lymph node, which was resected and found to represent metastatic Müllerian origin carcinoma. Gynecologic evaluation led to a definitive diagnosis of stage 4B fallopian tube carcinoma with metastatic involvement of the rectal mesentery and pelvic peritoneum. Debulking surgery was followed by carboplatin and docetaxel because of paclitaxel hypersensitivity and bevacizumab, which was followed by bevacizumab and 2 years of olaparib maintenance, which was recently completed.
Well, I've been following her with not only CT imaging and circulating tumor DNA assays, and she has remained NED. The CA125 levels are normal. She is planning prophylactic bilateral mastectomies, probably in January after her cytopenias recover from the olaparib, and we will continue monitoring her with ctDNA. So questions to the faculty about this case would be, what is the duration that you use for the olaparib? Do you stop after 2 years? And then what are you seeing as far as the risk of MDS and secondary leukemias using olaparib in the upfront maintenance setting versus in patients that are heavily pretreated? And what do you tell your patients about that risk of secondary leukemia and MDS?
Great question. So in general, when we talk about olaparib maintenance, you show data 2 years risk of MDS AML is meaningful. Is there a difference with niraparib in that space? And how do you sort of cage that discussion with the patient of the risk and benefits? And then we'll get in the second part of the question. I'll let you address that first.
Yeah, I really just treat 2 years with a PARP inhibitor based on the published data. Definitely encouraged to do that with the recent updates on MDS and secondary leukemias. And if you treat for 2 years, the data are clearly, even with extended follow-up now, 7-year follow-up, is below 1%. So I think that's a strong argument to say don't continue, and you have to argue with patients sometimes. They are in remission, the marker is normal, they're feeling well, they're tolerating the drug, and they feel they're giving up an effective treatment when they have to stop. But I think the data do show that it shouldn't be beyond 2 years. Now, niraparib was given a year longer. That may explain the reason why I think the results for subsequent treatments were less effective because there were more patients that progressed on the frontline maintenance therapy with niraparib, and that seems to be biologically a very different situation than progressing after completion of a PARP inhibitor. So I think there are a lot of arguments to say 2 years, that's where the evidence stands.
And you would offer that to all HRD-positive patients in the maintenance setting after their initial adjuvant therapy?
I would only offer it to those that are either have a BRCA somatic or germline mutation or are homologous recombination deficient. There are a few cases where, in some cases, you perform neoadjuvant chemotherapy or initial tissue biopsy so minute that the NGS panels can't determine HRD status. Then you rely on clinical factors. I think there's a good correlation between platinum response and response to PARP inhibitors. There are cases where you may say this was a very good response, like a near complete response to neoadjuvant chemotherapy, immediate drop of CA125 from 1,000 to just 60 after one or two cycles. That makes me comfortable to say, even if I don't have a reliable biomarker, BRCA non-mutated, I don't know the HRD status, I would offer, in the benefit of the doubt, a PARP inhibitor, but only for 2 years in that setting.
Perfect. So in the world of oncology, MRD testing to either escalate or de-escalate therapies becoming much more in vogue. Is there a role in this situation, particularly in the maintenance setting, to sort of identify early progressors?
Unfortunately, in GYN malignancies, we're not as advanced as in other diseases like GU tumors and breast cancer, where we've studied MDR better. I do use it as a tumor marker, particularly in patients where CA125 is not very reliable, but what does it mean having a negative ctDNA test, whether it's tumor-informed or non-informed? We don't have good prospective data. I think I use it as a tumor marker if protein markers are not available, but I think we need more data to say, you know, you are truly in remission because your test is negative. I would still treat based on what randomized data tell us in GYN.
Thank you. All right, next question. You address this to some degree. Is the 1 to 2% the number you quote when you talk about the risk of ALMDS for the PARP inhibitors at the 2-year mark?
I think it still applies. We don't clearly have to follow these patients longer. I mean, the risk can increase with any platinum-based or anthracycline-based therapy moving forward. But the studies with a higher risk include those where the treatment was given in the recurrent setting, in some cases repeatedly, and actually as a treatment after having had 3 or 4 prior platinums, like in ARIEL-3.
We saw some negative data on later line PARP therapy use. Mm-hmm. Can you describe a situation where you may consider reintroduction of a PARP inhibitor?
I think it's a great question. Unfortunately, I personally think that while a few years ago we were using too much PARP inhibitors, basically in an all-comer situation, regardless of biomarker, in the first line, second line, we're using it too cautiously now. I recall many patients that had very durable responses after having received a platinum-based regimen in the recurrent setting. Definitely I would consider it if they've not yet received a PARP inhibitor, even in the recurrent setting. And I think a case-by-case situation does justify using it in later lines. Clearly, we need to get better predictors of response, but also I think predictors of toxicity, and there are some interesting ideas, ChIP-seq and things like that, clonal hematopoiesis, which may allow us to identify patients that are at risk of developing MDS and just tailoring it more in patients with recurrent disease. It's a wave. You know, we've used it too frequently, and we've now been extremely conservative. I think it'll balance back. I think it is an active drug in select cases in the recurrent situation.
Perfect. Sort of as a corollary, a question from the audience came in. If you've had a patient whose BRCA positive mutation progressed after carboplatin and paclitaxel and surgery and laparib in that space with some residual neuropathy, standard rule applies, they're platinum sensitive. You go back to the platinum and taxane, and do you add bevacizumab in that space and then hope to continue that as a maintenance, or what are your thoughts there?
This is a patient that had a BRCA mutation in the front
had olaparib maintenance and then progress.
Yes. Well, bevacizumab is a great maintenance therapy, particularly in the recurrent situation. That's definitely an option. The question is of interest is, do you reuse a PARP inhibitor, PARP after PARP? And there is only very little data. There is an Oreo study which was significantly showed an improvement when using a PARP after PARP in BRCA-mutated patients, but the absolute difference was relatively small. But the caveat of that is that this was a study that looked at a very different patient population, is somewhat outdated to those patients that receive maintenance PARP inhibitor upfront, first line. I do think there are cases, particularly if there's a long platinum-free interval between the first and the recurrence, and they have an exquisite response to a platinum in the recurrent situation, to reconsider going back to maintenance therapy with a PARP inhibitor. Again, individualizing the treatment decision. Not generally using it, yes or no, but if there is still sensitivity and there's a chance that it will improve progression-free survival, it's worth considering after a balanced discussion with the patient about the potential toxicities.
Right, and that leads into our next case. The cytopenias in that setting may be real. And so, Dr. Lamar?
The next case is presented by Dr. Lamar.
I have a 64-year-old lady who developed abdominal pain and swelling and had a CT scan that showed a large left ovarian mass with some ascites. She was seen by gynecology oncology, underwent surgery, and then she came to see me. I talked to the gynecologist oncologist who was treating her, and it was recommended that she began a PARP inhibitor as maintenance therapy. And so we started her on olaparib, and she's been on therapy for about 6 months.
How's she doing on the olaparib?
She has had some cytopenias with olaparib, and so we have had to do dose reductions.
Did she need any transfusions?
We had to transfuse her once.
Any questions about this case?
So in patients who are receiving PARP inhibitors, what kinds of cytopenias are you all seeing? I have really struggled to keep patients on the standard dose of olaparib. I often find myself dose reducing. Are you all finding that a lot in your practice?
I'd like to know which PARP is favored and why. I'd like to know the utility of repeated debulking surgeries. Is there any role for immunotherapy-based regimens in an MSI-stable scenario?
So I think, you know, managing these PARP inhibitors in practice, we all, you know, deal with these cytopenias on a regular basis. Is there one that's better than another? How do you sort of mitigate the, you know, because they are associated with some morbidity on the patient side there. Dose reductions, what are your thoughts about how to manage those treatment-related cytopenias?
Yeah, so definitely dose reductions are commonly required. Again, the recommended dose is 300 milligram with the current formulation twice a day. But there's good data from the early studies where it was a different formulation, but they compared 400 milligram BID to half dose, 200 milligram BID. That was just a tablet and capsule formulation. That's why there are different doses. And that showed that actually the response rates in recurrent ovarian cancer were the same at the half dose. So that's kind of a guidance for me to say there is some wiggle room to reduce the dose. I feel very comfortable going from 300 BID to 200 if that's required based on thrombocytopenia or anemia. Now, anemia was seen at about 25% of grade 3, meaning requiring transfusions. One transfusion is not a reason to dose reduce, but if it becomes a reoccurring pattern, I think then you have to really consider dose reducing. And the nice thing is with the incremental decrease, you go to 250 BID or 300 BID. If you are using and familiar with niraparib is somewhat different because the starting dose is based on the weight and the platelets. If they're above 150,000 and above 77 kilo, you know, you go to 300 once a day. If you have 200, don't meet those criteria, going down to 100, that's a third of the dose. That makes me feel a little uncomfortable to say I'm still at an effective dose. But again, I think dose reductions are the way to solve cytopenias when using PARP inhibitors.
So you showed some really impactful data from the KEYNOTE-B96 trial, the first time immunotherapy sort of broken through in the ovarian cancer space. Exciting data looking at OS, as you mentioned. In those platinum-resistant patients, we have folate receptor alpha targets. We've got PD-1 targets now. Thinking through, would you try to, pending what approvals go with the KEYNOTE trial, how would you sequence these? What are your thoughts about how this may play out in therapies in practice for platinum-resistant disease?
Yeah, a great question. There's so much movement right now in the recurrent setting of ovarian cancer because of the new upcoming options. With the weekly Taxol and pembrolizumab, I personally am not so sure how it will apply to the U.S. Investigators or physicians because, again, most of the patients had one or two prior lines and received that regimen as a third line. In the U.S., we have access to a triple drug combination, oral cyclophosphamide, bevacizumab, and pembrolizumab, which is very well tolerated. We don't have phase 3 data from that study, but it is NCCN listed as a combination, and it introduces an immune checkpoint inhibitor earlier in the line, in the third line. So the question is there room for a taxane with pembrolizumab later in treatment then? And can you reuse a checkpoint inhibitor then if you've used it already with oral cyclophosphamide? So the sequencing has to be determined. Personally, I would see more value in then using when you've already had pembrolizumab with oral cyclophosphamide and bevacizumab is an extremely well-tolerated, highly efficacious regimen that you would then use Abraxane with relacorilant, for example, as an option.
Led into the next question. I was going to throw that. So what about relacorilant and how might that? So it's an amazing place, right? Historically, platinum-resistant disease, we had very limited options with very short durations of response, and now we've got three relatively targeted therapies, immunotherapy, antibody-drug conjugate, and now an endocrine therapy in that space. You want to talk a little bit more about your thoughts when relacorilant should become mainstream? Are we there based on the data that was presented?
Well, I think it's a completely new class of drugs. Glucocorticoid receptors may represent a strategy not to just improve the efficacy of Abraxane, but other regimens where you don't apply steroids. It's also addressed an interesting question is, have we been using too many steroids when we've been giving like weekly taxanes and something that we need to address in future studies. But because it's an unselected patient population with a significant survival benefit, I think it will be used. But I also see it possibly being used after you have targeted the folate receptor with an ADC in that subset of patients, or being used earlier in those that do not meet the expression criteria for mirvetuximab to be used. But I think we'll see a lot of different patterns emerging based on preference of the individual oncologist, but good thing to have new options that we didn't have a few years ago.
Yeah, thank you for your insights there. I know there's no clear-cut answer there, but thanks for... next is a case Sean Warsh is going to share with us.
The next case is presented by Dr. Warsh.
This is a 72-year-old female, overall very healthy, was being worked up for some vague abdominal pain. She went a CAT scan to get a better sense of what was going on. Unfortunately, found to have metastatic disease in the liver as well as the lung. She underwent a liver biopsy, which revealed adenocarcinoma consistent with the GYN primary, likely an ovarian source. We sent full NGS testing. This revealed an FOLR1 as well as an ERBB2. 2+ on IHC, as well as estrogen receptor positive 2+. I was curious, given her ER positivity, would we add in maintenance aromatase inhibitor? And she had this FOLR1. It's sort of new to me as a medical oncologist, but I'm curious how common do we see that in GYN malignancies? And it is targetable with a new medicine, mirvetuximab. And that's a targetable option that I believe is an option in second line. Along with the HER2 positivity, we'd also consider TDXD in second line. So she has a couple options in our back pocket for second line. So I'm curious which one we would consider. What do we think the likelihood of response is with the mirvetuximab compared to the HER2 mutation?
Any questions about using mirvetuximab?
Yeah. What sort of toxicities do you anticipate? It definitely seems like a good option. The data is great. As someone who hasn't used it yet, just curious what toxicities you look for. I read that there's some potential for some serious ocular toxicity. So just curious, how do you manage that? And is there any other side effects that you would look for as someone starting this therapy?
Okay, quickly. So for that folate receptor alpha positive patient who's also HER2 positive based on the pan tumor data, what would your preferences be as far as an antibody drug conjugate in that space?
It's a good question because we're fortunate to have these options now, which we didn't have a year ago to have to be able to make these choices. In this case, there is no direct data from ovarian cancer on what's the best sequencing, and I kind of looked to other malignancies like breast cancer where there is some data suggests that if you pre-treat with a microtubulin inhibitor and then follow by a topoisomerase inhibitor and not vice versa, start with a topoisomerase inhibitor payload first and then followed by mirvetuximab, for example, that may be a better strategy, but there's really no data to say what's the most suitable sequence. You could base your decision on the side effect profile of these drugs, and the previous physician just raised the question, what are the side effects? Ocular toxicity is seen with mirvetuximab, however, it's always reversible. This is these are small inclusion cysts in the cornea that fade out by holding the drug for a week or by dose reducing. Again, it occurs in about 50% of patients, but none of the patients on trials, or to my experience, have permanent damage of vision or visual acuity, so it's really reversible. But it can be a challenge if you have underlying ocular loss of visual acuity. On the other hand, the rate of potential pulmonary toxicity may be slightly higher if you use T-DXd, and if someone has an underlying pneumonitis or a history of pulmonary ailments, that may be what directs you towards one of the two. But I think we have no data yet, as we have in retrospective data sets from breast cancer, that there is a certain sequence that you want to prevent. They have different payloads, so hopefully the patient will have access to both.
Would it matter? The GOG allows an IHC 2+, right? The label's more for the pan-tumor indication in the 3+ space. Would that impact your decision if you had a folate receptor alpha of 85% and a 2+? Does that impact versus the inversion of that? I think there was a trial looking at 25 to 75% expression of folate receptor alpha. Do we have any insight into that yet?
Well, the problem with folate receptor testing as well as HER2 testing is that immunohistochemistry is extremely inaccurate, and it can be affected by tissue processing, formalin fixation, tissue degradation by just embedding it, we know that from various published studies now that the reproducibility of HER2 and folate receptor testing is pretty low, meaning you send out a different specimen, you get a different cutoff. And that's probably why the study that looked at a wider range of patients, 25 above percent expression of 2+ intensity, also yielded really promising efficacy data and led to the NCCN adoption and guidelines that you can treat patients. That study was just coincidentally conducted together with bevacizumab, so the NCCN listings now include mirvetuximab plus bevacizumab in patients that have 25 or plus cutoffs. It's just a reflection that testing is not very reproducible, and that has implications for clinicians to really think about if you have a test result that doesn't meet inclusion criteria to go back and consider doing a new test or even obtaining a new biopsy.
Well, in the HER2 low space in breast cancer has taught us that, if nothing else, for sure. Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Konecny, for your insight and wisdom and for the oncologists, both online and in person. And thanks for being here today. Okay.
Pleasure. Thank you.